Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
So we get better flavour because of the Fen soil.
I've drunk more beer since I came here and bought my two barrels than I've ever done in my life before, I think.
I shouldn't have said almonds. They don't make it from almonds.
So you've got this big sticky mess when you start off.
Pizza pot pies.
My wife's cakes are selling at hot cakes. Brilliant, thank you.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, your fortnightly guide to independent food and drink in and around Cambridge. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. Sue Bailey won't be joining us in the studio today, but she did leave us with an interesting feature looking ahead to Christmas.
Yes, and today we'll also be covering the latest food book hot off the press. We'll be talking about orchards, wine, cru bourgeois to be exact, and restaurants, a Spanish restaurant to be exact.
So let's begin with that book. The title is Fitzbillies, and it's based on Fitzbillies, of course, and it launched this week. I caught up with the owners, Alison Wright and Tim Hayward, to reflect on the time, 8 years ago now, when they took the business on and made it their own. Here's Alison.
I was sitting at my desk in the advertising agency I worked in London one afternoon. I saw on Twitter, oh no, Fitzbillies has closed. And immediately I was shocked. I wanted to find out what was going on, and I sort of couldn't believe it, and I was filled with a sort of tingling excitement, really. And although I was meant to go out to a meeting, I'm like, I'm going to skip this meeting. And I got on Google and rang up the newspaper where he had seen the story. It linked back to the Cambridge News, and I found out who the official receiver was and who the landlord was, and I just sort of started researching, because I felt very much that Fitzbillies was such a wonderful institution and so beloved of Cambridge that I couldn't believe it had closed down.
You thought you might like to go ahead and take it on.
It sounds kind of mad, but I was filled with literally an urge to go and solve this situation. Yeah, it was really one of those life-changing moments. And I'd always been a keen baker and enthusiast. I'd known Fitzbillies as a child. And I'm like, this is the one for me. This is the moment. And I pursued it relentlessly.
No, I mean, for me, it was, you know, I was writing about food and the food industry, and I was immersed in the food industry, and I thought Al was mad. I thought she was sentimental and bonkers. I mean, I hadn't grown up in Cambridge. I didn't understand. I just thought high streets are going to be a mess. You know, we're on the lip of a recession. It's all falling apart. And the last thing you want to be is a bakery that's frankly just failed in a small town. I think I'd been to Cambridge once. So for me, I was quite rude when she phoned me. I said, you're bloody mad. I think for me, the realisation that there was something incredibly powerful in the relationship of the town to the restaurant, or the cafe, or the cake shop, or whatever incarnation it had. Mm. Cambridge owns Fitzbillies, and it's it always will. It's that relationship that's important. Al could see that, and I couldn't. So we decided we're going to put a business plan together. That was Al's suggestion, and she drove it. I said, well, okay, we'll get some people together. And I had a lot of friends in the industry, so I was able to pull together friends. I had a particular mate who was running he was a GM of a Michelin-starred restaurant at the time, so we were able to get him in to spend. And I think we invited him round for lunch, and it was going to be half an hour of sitting down and making a few notes. And he said, you know, get your pens out, get your paper out, started talking, and it was 4 hours later and we were still making notes. We had literally no idea how many things we'd have to think about, from who was going to supply the toilet paper through to the sound reflectance of the floor, the colour of the walls, tills. I mean, there was so much stuff. We literally had, but Al took all that information and made it into a plan. I suppose I had in my mind the idea of coming up here and doing what sort of Dalesford Organic would have done. Some kind of, you know, let's paint the whole place in artsy colours and put the prices up and sell arty things to them. And Al was, no, you don't get it. These are Cambridge people. They are very different. They're restrained, they're conservative. They'll see through that nonsense straight away. And so the exercise of gently settling ourselves into that community that then became so important became the entire process of what we were doing. It was incredibly, incredibly key. And I think if Al hadn't been a Cambridge girl properly. I mean, properly ingrained. Your father was a bursar.
He was bursar at St Catherine's, just across the road. So that was one of the reasons that I came to Fitzwilliam so often, I'm sure, when I was
but
a
it,
child.
But it meant that you were immersed in Cambridge in a way that I could never be.
And you understood Cambridge, and you've used that in making it successful.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we do live alongside the colleges. We're not part of the university, but we kind of almost are. I think there's a very busy daytime environment for cafe society. There are undergraduates between lectures. There are tutors and professors who need to come out and have lunch with their colleagues. There's people who need to write their thesis somewhere that isn't their small room. So while a lot of our customers are not university people, the university does creates a particular flavour in this part of Cambridge, and I think we really benefit from that.
It's not just because I remember when we first won the opportunity to be here, I was taken for a walk around the green in the college by the then master. He was talking about Fitzbillies and how it was very much like a college, and one was a caretaker rather than an owner of a place, and one didn't think one should ever feel that they had a proprietorial sense over what was going on. And I felt like I was being groomed for MI5 or something. But what he was trying to communicate was this thing that a Londoner really finds quite difficult to conceive of. This place is older than us, longer than us. It'll be here long after we're dead, and it will still have a relationship with the town when they've forgotten our names. So, yeah, there's a certain element of we've learned to very quickly to behave like a college, like a university institution. So, no, we're not. We're not a college. We're not part of a university. Emphatically not. We are the youngest institution in a town full of ancient institutions.
And then you had to reopen and change it because it hadn't worked, had it?
We took on a business where the previous two owners had gone bankrupt, so you have to think quite hard about what you're going to do differently. I think we've done a number of things differently. The first and most obvious thing is that we've used the space very differently. So if you remember old Fitzbillies more than 10 years ago, there was just the tiny little shop and a cafe with maybe 30 seats on the corner. The whole area through into the back that was previously staff changing rooms, a servery area. We've now got over 100 seats in here, so we've made much, much better use of the space. I think we've also understood how people eat and drink nowadays, so things like really lovely coffee. Someone can come and have a cup of coffee three times a day, and many of our customers do, whereas probably you'd only buy a Chelsea bun once a day. So those more regular occasions and brunch and savoury food in addition to the bakery have been really important for us.
When we arrived, there was no coffee. Do you remember that? Oh, there were no coffee shops in Cambridge. We opened our coffee shop around the same time as Hot Numbers. And those were the first two.
That's incredible.
Isn't it bonkers? 8.5 years and you know, we broke coffee in Cambridge. It's mad. It used to be that when students went out to eat, they would have a bun and a cup of tea, and a bun and a cup of tea was what students ate. That was before they had 1,000 different opportunities to cater for themselves or there were other places in competition. Now, students, I don't know the last time they may have eaten, they may have been at Yale or Harvard or Stanford or something like that. You know, they need to have avocados on toast. They need to have really, really high-quality coffee. We need to supply that.
And it's the core of Fitzbillies, the heart of Fitzbillies is the Chelsea buns and the bakery.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
But when I read the book, I mean, Chelsea buns are mentioned frequently and with some lovely photographs of them being made as well. But another thing which is mentioned frequently in the earlier part of the book is the sponge cake, which clearly died away. And I was wondering why the one survived and the other one didn't.
Yeah, it is very interesting. So the lady, Philomena Gilbo, who told us about the sponge cake recipe, she said it was never made again after the war. I think it took 8 eggs for one cake. And I think that meant that through the whole period of rationing, it was just an impossibility. But I also think that over the years, tastes have changed, and that was a fatless sponge. And nowadays, no one would want to eat that cake. People want to eat very moist cakes like carrot cake with oil in. And I think it was probably a cake of its time. Right. And it just wouldn't meet modern standards, which require a much moister cake.
Okay, I think finally,
One of the things in the book is 24 hours in the life of Fitzbillies, which amazed me. I mean, I'm aware, you know, because I do come into Fitzbillies from time to time, and it is a very busy place. I mean, particularly the weekend, when sometimes I think half of Cambridge is either in or queuing up outside. But despite the intensity of it, you've taken on other businesses. Obviously, you've opened up the second branch, you've bought the Cobbs Bakery. That must make your lives pretty different from what they were when you first started.
So I think when we took over Fitzbillies, so when we worked in London, I guess we had the stresses and strains of those sorts of executive London jobs.
Horrible yuppie lifestyles.
When we took on Fitzbillies, there's that crazy day-to-day of, it wasn't a new business, but it was like starting a new business. I think that what happens is each time something settles down, you find the next project. And there is, in bakery, there is a drive to scale, because if you're making a particular type of cake or loaf, it's really just as easy to make twice as many. So once you've got one branch, having another branch seems like a good idea. And then you go, oh, we need some more space. Let's have an off-site bakery. And we've always wanted to make bread. Let's make bread. So then you go, okay, we've got all these bread and cakes. Let's get another business. Here's a great site on Mill Road, and Scott wants to start something himself, so let's support that. So the business sort of drives you on to do the next thing.
But also to be fair, I mean, given the standards of other companies of our scale in other parts of the country, our development has been glacially slow. I mean, you know, we are not interested in expanding outside of this town. And we want to expand. We don't want to expand. We open as it becomes apparent that we ought to do so. If something comes up on the other side of town that would enable us to service that group of people better or more conveniently, yeah, we go for that. If one of our suppliers, as it was with Cobbs, finds itself in a little trouble, and we think, God, what are we going to do without our buns? Those guys make our baps. We couldn't make a bacon roll without them. What can you do? It's a very, very organic and very audience-focused process. Every expansion we've made has basically been led by the same Cambridge audience and not by some group of investors. So, yeah, it is actually appallingly slow. Any business school graduate would look at it and go, you're really not doing the right thing. But I think we're okay on it, aren't we?
Yeah, we're okay.
I think the people of Cambridge think you're doing the right thing. So thank you very much.
And we'll have more from them in just a moment, because Alan, Sue and myself went along to the book launch, which was held at Fitzbillies one particularly rainy night this week. Sarah Lavelle published the book, and Sarah, as regular listeners will know, is a fairly frequent voice here on Flavour, because she often comes in to tell us about her latest titles from Quadrille Publishing. So the book itself is a celebration of Fitzbillies, and we wanted to try and capture a little bit of that by recording a selection of key Fitzbillies voices from that important evening. And we begin with Tim Hayward.
We're celebrating the launch of the book and also of 100 years of this place. It's been 8.5 years since we took it over. We're still here, we're still alive, it's still going, and we love it, so that's great. And we've done a book, and that's marvellous.
Hi, I'm Linda. I met Tim when he was first starting out writing, and when Alison and Tim were looking at taking over Fitzbillies, they asked me to help them with that because I'm an accountant by training, and I was like, ooh, Fitzbillies, I remember that. Both of my brothers were at Cambridge University and they both rode for the lightweights, and one of them was actually in a crew that was sponsored by Fitzbillies back in the day, so I knew of Fitzbillies and I'd heard of the very famous Chelsea Bun, so I was delighted to be involved, and I've been involved ever since.
Excellent. And do you get payment in Chelsea buns every now and again?
Sometimes, yes. Although I don't have that sweet tooth, so I prefer to have a sausage roll or something else.
Fair enough. Thank you.
So, welcome to some special guests, first of all. Jill Abbs. Is Jill around somewhere? Yeah. We have a wave from Jill. Jill is our head baker. She started with Fitzbillies in 1971. We reckon she's made 5 million Chelsea buns. I did some sums. There's a certain number of buns in a tray, and a tray is a very, very fixed dimension. So it's a lovely exercise. I spent 2 days, when I should have been doing something much more important, just going through Google trying to work out what you could do with 5 million buns. If you stack them from end to end, they would go from here to the International Space Station.
Jill, you were working at Fitzwillie's quite a long time ago, weren't you?
In 1971.
And what were you doing?
Mainly what I'm doing now, making the Chelsea buns, cake bases, finishing cakes.
I heard that when Fitzwillie's actually did close down, you'd got a job with another baker. And also that you were a particularly important person because you had the recipe for Chelsea buns in your head.
That's correct. So nobody had the recipe.
How were you enticed back into Fitzwillie's then? Was that Tim's doing?
Well, it's my doing, I think. I'd worked here all my life and, you know, it's what I love doing. And, I just love Fitzwillie's, really.
Why?
I guess when I came here, it was a place that everybody wanted to work. And there aren't any bakeries that are very good today, so it's a traditional bakery.
And you're still really enjoying it, presumably?
Yes, I do, and I like working for Tim and Alison because they brought Fitzwillie's back to life. So, you know, that's nice.
They must have been delighted that you had the recipe for Chelsea buns in your head.
Yeah, I would have given the recipe to them anyway, you know, whether I came back to
work. Oh, well, that's very public-spirited. In the book, it talks about, I suppose, the changing habits or tastes in what fat to use in baking. There was a period when people didn't think margarine was good and they wanted unsalted butter. But there was a time when people used to bake things like scones, things like pastry, with lard.
Yes, they did. I remember my mother baking with lard, and I still bake with lard at home. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think, you know, it's a good fat.
But it's not used professionally much anymore.
No, it isn't. And I don't know why. I guess it's sort of like people's changing their way of eating. They want more, or they think they want a healthier fat.
And they don't see lard as being healthy.
No, they don't. Yeah. When, you know, I think it's in a small moderation, I think it's still good for you.
Yeah. And does it make much difference to the flavour, do you think?
I think so, and you also get a crispier pastry with it. When I make pastry and I use lard, it's always got a crispiness about it.
Lovely. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jill.
Okay.
And thank you for coming back to Fitzwillie's.
Then, the person without whom we wouldn't actually know that it was the 100th anniversary. So for a long time, we thought it was 1922. And then Alison met Caroline Biggs, who's the founder of the Cambridge Historical Society, a history festival, and she had the wit to actually look through old editions of the Cambridge News. And it turned out that it was 4th of October 1920. So thanks, Caroline, because otherwise this would all be a complete mess.
I'm Caroline Biggs. I helped to start Eat Cambridge Food Festival and Cambridge History Festival. I've always lived in Cambridge. I have a real passion for it. And I have a real passion for Fitzwillie's. I grew up with Fitzwillie's. Back in the late 70s, I was to work over the road in the maths faculty. And I used to save up to come on a Friday and treat myself to one of their lovely cakes. But it was a bit of an intimidating experience because I'd walk in and I'd attentively point to a bun and say, "Can I have one of those?" They'd say, "Do you mean a Bath bun, madam?" And I just say yes, and then they'd carefully package it up. Then one day I came in and said, "I'd try and guess what the buns were." I said, "Can I have an Eccles cake?" and pointed to a cake, but it wasn't the right cake. So they told me off. So it was always a slightly daunting experience coming into Fitzwillie's. But once you'd got out with the bag of goodies and you got back to your office, it was pure joy.
So when we came in, we were marketeers. The first thing we thought we'd do is segment the audience and draw charts and work out, you know, we've got people from the colleges and we'll have students and then we'll have tourists and that. It was, within about a week, it turned out to be utter rubbish. Because you can't do that. It's not like that. It is a really, really weird, nutty, bonkers, sweet community. It's a really important thing to be part of. I've never met a place where people are odder, nicer, grumpier in the winter, more really seriously unpleasant to each other on the roads than anywhere else I've ever been. But just, it's so lovely, it's so Cambridge, it's so nice. And then when people say, "What's your customer base like?" You know, old pros in the industry, I have literally no idea. The next person who walks through could be a Nobelist or a nutter. Every restaurant I know that launched at the time that we did was talking about, "Yes, yeah, we're seasonal local. All of our food comes from 150 yards of the front door. We only use dead feral pigeons." And yeah. But Cambridge community is interesting because actually you do realise that there's a very different thing going on, which is local businesses, local people. So actually you nuzzle yourself into something that's much more about real localism than any of the things that we talk about. And I say that as a journalist, and I'm looking at you as a chef, and I know you feel the same way. It's that kind of
this is how we fit in now. And I think it's lovely. And I think one of the most important things about Fitzbillies, if we ever had to declare it in a single sentence, is that thing about getting the fit with community correct.
Hi, my name is Pippa Sanderson, and I moved to Cambridge in 1993 and moved to the Milne Road area and then met my husband in 2000. And when we decided to get married, there was only one place that was the absolute place, the only place in Cambridge to get your wedding cake made. So we approached the then owner and they made us the most beautiful cake, and it was a three-tiered cake, white icing, and it reflected our flowers on it, which were canna lilies. And I actually still have the top tier of the cake at home. But it was 16 years ago, so it was 2003, so I'm not entirely sure whether it's edible anymore. I don't think so.
That's lovely.
But it's a lovely memory, and actually coming here tonight has actually made me realise that memory, which had completely gone into my... So I'm going to send them an image. Obviously, we have our wedding pictures and we have several of the cake. So I will message them with some beautiful photos. And it's been really nice. It's been really nice to share the, you know, celebration of, you know, coming up to 100 years of this wonderful business.
It's fantastic. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure.
My name's Kirsty Chapman, cake princess in the book. So I started work here in 2003 as a waitress. Really loved it because it was like an independent cafe, cake shop. Worked here for 7 years, then obviously the business folded. Met up with Tim and Alison as they were taking over the place. The place has expanded. You know, we haven't gone all technical or anything. We've kept it all traditional, which is what people come here for. We have another branch now on Bridge Street. We also have our bakery, which is on Clifton Road, where we do wholesale bread. All of our cakes come from there. It's just, yeah.
Paul, you're in charge of bread production at Fitzbillies. I think you said you've been baking for about 30 years.
Yeah, I'm the bakery manager at Fitzbillies, so I oversee the unit with the bread and cakes, and I have two head bakers under me. So Jill on the cake side, who I think you've met, and Sam Summerly on the night shift.
We know that in and around Cambridge, getting good stuff is really difficult. How did Alison find you?
I used to work in a Cambridge bakery a few years ago. Alison contacted me with an idea that she might be buying a bread bakery, as the owner wasn't very well. He supplied a lot of their soft baps and rolls that they like to use in the restaurants. To maintain that standard, she thought the best way would be to buy the bakery. But obviously, the bakery was missing the head baker. So she asked me if I would be interested in coming aboard. I, of course, said yes. I know Fitzbillies was really pleased for the challenge, and yes, yeah. I came along.
Good, good. Flour has changed. Is that something you have to keep abreast of?
Yeah, the quality has definitely changed in this country. People are more educated in what they want to buy. When I started, people were interested in brown bread and white bread. There was a lot of additives going into the flours. Not necessarily cheaper, but maybe not so high quality, or grown in a climate that wasn't really designed for flour. Nowadays, everybody expects a little bit more. People like their specific sourdoughs or pastry. And that all takes different types of flour. A lot of our suppliers, they'll take you out and they'll demonstrate flours. They'll bring people over from France to demonstrate French pastry, baguettes. It's a whole education for the bakers as well.
So what you're baking at Fitzbillies is sort of evolving, really. If you come across a more suitable flour, you might very well switch to that one.
Yeah, we would. We follow the principles of Cambridge Organic Bakery, which is the bakery we bought. Their principles were to keep it organic. So the majority of our breads are still organic, but our other breads are evolving. And the sourdoughs we've introduced, we like it to be quite mild. We have one that's tougher and stronger for people that already know sourdough and like sourdough. And there's a softer one that hopefully families and children will be more interested in.
Lots of less acidic.
Slightly milder, and it's softer as well, so it's a softer crumb, so it's not quite such an ordeal to chew. When you get young people introduced to sourdough, that's a good thing. But their education and their tastes change. And then they go on to the stronger one. So it's always, we're always evolving. And if the customers want something even stronger, tangier, tougher, then we'll make it.
Do you actually get customers saying, I wish your sourdough was stronger, tangier, tougher?
We do. About once a month, we cut up some bread and we butter it and allow people to come and take some samples and taste it. And I always ask people what they think. A lot of people will taste one and say, no, it's not tangy enough. They'll taste the other. Yeah, that one's okay, but sometimes I like stronger. So, yeah, tastes have definitely changed, and they'll keep changing. But if you get used to a strong sourdough, after a while, it no longer tastes strong to you. So you want to move. It's like you've upgraded onto the next plateau of sourdough.
What are we going to be eating in 50 years?
Well, hopefully good bread still.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Paul.
All right, no, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, the book. Thank you.
It was a lovely evening. The book is beautiful, celebrating, as you heard, 100 years of the shop, the staff, their stories, their cakes and their recipes. It's available direct from Fitzbillies on Trumpington Street and also from their website, fitzbillies.com, priced £20.
Culinaris, the delicatessen, opened almost 4 years ago now, on the day of the Mill Road Winter Fair, and with Yuletide on the way, we're heading back there courtesy of Sue Bailey.
I'm standing in Culinaris, Mill Road, and I'm speaking to Sam Ryan, who is the manager, and finding out a little bit more about what's coming up for Christmas and your involvement with the Mill Road Winter Fair.
We're obviously a trader on Mill Road, and the Winter Fair's a great day for trying lots of different things and getting into contact with local traders and independents to see what they're selling that year. So panettone will be huge for us. Our roots in Hungary provide us with a fantastic baked good that the Hungarians like at Christmas. It's called bagli, and it's a thing that we've sold every Christmas since we've opened, a poppy seed strudel. So yeah, it goes down very well.
Yeah, so when you're baking this, you need to get a decent rise on the pastry, but it also has to vent vapour because the poppy seed filling is quite wet, so it has to eject the steam somehow. It tends to crack along the bottom anyway, and that's the sign of a well-filled bagel.
So poppy seeds represent having plenty. That's why they used to throw poppy seeds at newlyweds.
So they don't throw bagels at newlyweds.
No, that would be really weird.
So a basic bagely pastry uses some milk,
sugar,
yeast,
flour,
butter,
and eggs.
The filling could be made from ground walnuts
or poppy seeds
with some sugar,
milk,
apricot jam,
raisins,
and some egg wash at the end.
To be completely traditional, a family would have two of these bagels, the walnut version and the poppy seed version.
Everybody makes them both, even if they don't really like one of them.
The Hungarian palate, it doesn't really go for sweet foods. And when it comes to Christmas time, the bagel is one of the few sweet things on the table for Christmas.
We usually have something called a salonzucker to hang on the Christmas tree, but it's more like a candy covered in chocolate. Salonzucker. Zucker means the sugar. There are some really good Hungarian sweet makers who make a really good quality salonzucker.
In addition to that, I'll probably be making my own mince pies. We'll have lots
Excellent.
Of cheeses from some local suppliers. And we have a very special guest of a local chocolatier with us. Anissa has been producing truffles in Cambridge for a little while, but she's just released a range of single origin bars, which we're huge fans of in the shop. She also has a secret lineup of a few other flavours, which you'll have to come along to find out about.
Ooh, what is her name?
Her name's Anissa.
Anissa. And there are so many amazing things that, for a foodie Christmas present here, I am filling up about 23 hampers already, I think, with all the things that I'm seeing here. What do you find sell best at Christmas, apart from panettone?
We have a lot of people who come in here to find products for people who like to cook a lot at home, who associate themselves with the foodie kind of scene and really want to try something unusual. Mm. There's always something interesting that you can find on the shelves here. It's sort of a library of unusual food, and that kind of thing is really exciting to some.
Yes, I was noticing all the herbs and spices there, and last time I was here, there was a charming lady from Oxford specifically to buy cheeses from yourself. As she said, you know, Oxford doesn't have an equivalent delicatessen, which is very flattering.
It's good to hear, yeah. We like to be able to provide people with a unique shopping experience, so without just selling things that happen to be on the shelves.
And you also have some truffle products. These are the savoury truffles, the sort of
truffle fungus, and you've got truffle crisps, you have truffle cheese, is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we've traded with a really great company in Alba for many years called Tartiflanger. They have a big range of different things that they sell, from white truffle, black truffle, summer and winter. But we also have connections with lots of cheese producers, particularly in Switzerland and France, who use a lot of truffle products in their cheeses. So that's where those two things come from. Mm. Alongside those kind of things, there's always really innovative products around in the food scene. So you never know what you might find truffle in.
And I also noticed you have fresh truffles advertised on the door.
Yeah, we do.
That's unusual, yeah, to actually be able to get hold of fresh truffles for somebody who's not a restaurateur.
They're quite difficult to handle, but we manage them through the fresh counter, and everything seems to be going quite well so far. It's a unique experience to be able to come and see a fresh truffle in the flesh.
Exactly, exactly. So what do you mean difficult to handle?
They have a very short shelf life. You have to keep them quite consistently humid, but not too humid, and you need to keep them cold. Plus the travel time has to be very minimal to preserve the intensity of aroma, really. Yeah.
If you were asked what would be your perfect Christmas present from one of the products in the shop, what would you say?
At the moment, I'm really into our wine selection. So if you could find a wine that was both delicious and also unique that I hadn't tried before, then that would be perfect for me.
I can also see all this amazing range of chocolates here in front of me, with so many different types of chocolates with some of the most amazing flavours, I was noticing. Over on this other side, you've got some very strange chocolates, very interesting combinations. Do they sell well?
Yeah, just as we were talking about earlier, people are looking for interesting things they might not have tried before. So if you want to try a chocolate with some mushrooms in it, you can do it here.
Yes, and I noticed a chocolate with bacon, for example.
Yeah, there's a lot of interest in that side of our business at the moment. Craft chocolate is on the up, so it's a real privilege to be able to sell such an amazing range of such high quality chocolate and give people choices to see what they might like and might not like.
Fantastic. And the most amazing cheese selection, the most amazing deli counter with all different types of sausages and hams I can see there, and I see caviar as well. So perhaps if somebody really loved me, that might be on my Christmas list.
That's an interesting world that I haven't really encountered before I started working here. It's still not really for me, but it's interesting to try the difference between all of these different products.
Sam, thank you very much indeed.
No,
so
problem.
Make sure you come along to the Winter Fair.
It will be the 7th of December, Saturday the 7th.
And that's when the whole of Mill Road is closed, and there's all sorts of things going on.
Exactly. We're here from 10 o'clock, I think, until the road reopens at around 5, I think. So sometime during the day on that Saturday. Yeah.
Perfect. And come in and enjoy.
So that's us, Culinaris at 88 Mill Road. Pop in for a sample anytime. Have a good Christmas.
And Culinaris is open from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday to Saturday, and 11 till 6 on Sundays. 2,000 delicacies under one roof, so says their website, and Sue certainly picked out a lot of them. And you can find out plenty more on their site, culinaris.co.uk. They also sell their goods wholesale if you'd like their stock in larger quantities, and why not? You can also catch them on Twitter at Culinaris UK. And in Sue's feature, they mentioned Anissa Chocolate. And Anissa is the Cambridge chocolatier. And they were tweeting about her wares just yesterday. In particular, the limited edition gingerbread chocolate, which is made with Culinaris' own gingerbread spice. Really getting into that festive spirit.
Time for an exclusive preview now of the food that will be available at new Spanish restaurant Mercado Central on Green Street. Our undercover reporter, Rosie Sykes, has the lowdown.
They've got a lot of ideas about what they want. The main team, which is Lee and Mark Hughes and Daniel Durang, who is an amazing supplier of Spanish products. So they have a lot of ideas on their menu, and they have incredible produce and got an amazing team there already.
Oh, have they? They're already employing people.
Yes, yeah. They've got three Spanish chefs, a wonderful head chef called Remedios, and her husband Jose, who's a pastry chef. So he'll be making a lot of bread and pastry. And then another Spanish guy called Javier, and then a couple of other chefs, Alex and Frankie. So yeah, they have a decent team already, which is great.
A sizable operation by the
sound of it. Yes, it will.
What sort of foods are they getting in?
Daniel has a very impressive Spanish import business. The whole point of his business is that everything he buys is the best that he can find. So the best anchovies, the best jamón, incredible embutidos, as they call them in Spanish, which is, you know, all the different salamis and chorizo, morcilla, beautiful embutidos, wonderful anchovies, incredible olive oil from an estate where they employ 60% handicapped people. So everything Danny buys has a story. It may be that it's been in the family for 400 years. It may be, like I say, about the olive oil. But what is most important to him is that everything is great. And in a way, that makes our job a lot easier because we just want to make this incredible produce sing. So he's got beautiful rice. There'll be a lot of lovely rice dishes on the menu. There's going to be really good fish, which obviously we'll source a lot of the fish from the UK, but there's lovely tuna, jarred tuna, incredible octopus that is cooked in Galicia and then vac-packed. It is so tender and so delicious, so we'll be using some of that. Lovely almonds that Danny buys from one farm, and they only roast them, Marcona almonds, the best almond. And they only roast them when Danny asks them to. So they keep them in their raw state and then roast them to order, really, which is an incredible way to do it. It means they're much fresher and nicer. So just those few stories will show you that everything coming out of there will be really wonderful. The wonderful pluma, which is the Iberico, fresh Iberico pork, which is the shoulder, a fillet from the back of the shoulder, I think it is. Anyways, pluma is delicious. But then some really good English beef and lamb, game on the menu as well. So although it is Spanish predominantly, we'll be using English produce as well, obviously.
I suppose really the Spanish have a reputation for enjoying meat. Spanish-speaking people through the world, I suppose, really have a reputation for enjoying meat. And in Spain itself, a lot of fish. And
yes.
You've mentioned the meat and fish.
Yeah.
But, I mean, in this country, you know, there is, of course, this move towards veganism or possibly vegetarianism, you know, if you're on the liberal wing. But will people be catered for in
those? Absolutely, yes, making sure that we have a couple of vegan and a few vegetarian dishes, for sure, because we all think it's important.
Yeah. And some good desserts?
Yes, it's for pastry chef Jose, who will be making the bread and pastry and ice creams and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, when you see the restaurant from the street, it's a tall building and all of it seems to have been subject to sort of building alterations. So it looks like a sizable operation.
Indeed. So the ground floor is going to be a bar and there's a kitchen in the bar. So you'll be able to see the chefs cooking. There's a wonderful ox grill. There's a plancha. An ox grill is the one that's on a wheel so you can move it up and down. There's a lovely plancha. So they'll be cooking a lot of meat and fish upstairs. And then there's a kitchen downstairs in the basement, which actually used to be, in its previous incarnation, was where they sat the diners, which, having worked down there, I find utterly extraordinary because it's a beautiful building with, you know, first floor has incredible sash windows and is a lovely space, which is an obvious dining room, and that's what it will be.
And the last we heard was that the likely opening date is somewhere sort of late-ish November.
That's right.
Is that
still on? It's still looking that way, yeah.
Right, well, we'll look forward to that absolutely enormously.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And apart from anything else, I'm really excited to have somewhere really lovely to eat in central Cambridge.
Yeah. So good. Well, that's tremendous. That's really good news.
Good.
So thank you very much.
That's a pleasure.
And I'm sure we are all looking forward to the imminent opening of Mercado Central and some of that wonderful Galician seafood they mentioned on their Facebook page. Really eye-catching building too.
Food historian and cook Monica Askey has featured on some of our recent episodes, such as when I paid a visit to Heath Fruit Farm in Bluntisham in September with her, and more recently discussing autumnal fruits. Here's Monica once again, this time talking about an orchard project and other projects that you might like to get involved in.
Now, I know you're involved in an Orchards project. Could you just tell us something briefly about that?
Yes, it's called Orchards East. It's a just over three-year project, which comes to an end in August next year, funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund, based at UEA in Norwich. It covers six counties, so Cambridgeshire is one, and then Suffolk, Norfolk, Essex, Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire. And it's concerned with a whole range of things to do with orchards. There's an oral history project. There are orchard surveys to see where the orchards were on the, I think it's the round about the 1905 ordnance survey maps, and to see what still exists and compare it with the PTES, People's Trust for Endangered Species, did some aerial surveys. So not all the things that they spotted actually were orchards, but most of them were. So they compared the various maps, basically, and then sent people in on the ground to have a look. And then having seen what was still there, there's a further stage of surveys which is looking into all the biodiversity. So it's looking into things like insect populations, mosses, lichens, that sort of thing. So there's that side of it. There's the culinary side of it, which is my bit. And I've done several things to do with that. I've done cookery demonstrations with tastings at Apple Days and Plum Days. I've done, well, what I've done last year and I'm planning on doing again this year, so if anybody is interested, please let me know, is running hands-on cookery workshops for assorted groups. But it's groups of, it could be based around an allotment project, but it's people who possibly have a variety of needs, maybe long-term unemployment or socially isolated or older people or young families.
So how can people get in touch?
I think possibly the best is if I give my email address, which is info@monica, which is MONICA, hyphen ASKAY.co.uk. But I am wanting to set those up pretty quickly, so okay. They'll be for the autumn when obviously the fruit's in season.
Good thinking.
But it's only a limited number. I can only sort of do possibly about four. But
thank you very much.
That's quite all right. Another aspect of the project, of course, is keeping orchard skills alive. Things like propagating, so grafting, orchard management.
Are these the skills which are being lost, are they?
Oh, yes, very much so. And interestingly enough, I think some schools in the past did have, some secondary schools did have a sort of farming aspect to them. And some of the older people we've talked to have said that they learned how to graft in school. But obviously that's not happening now.
It's all being squeezed out.
Although where schools are involved in the project, then yes, maybe those skills are coming back.
Right, so there are some schools involved in the project. Right.
Yes. Yeah, so it is things like how to manage the trees, that you would prune stone fruit differently from the way you prune apples and pears, for instance. Also with grafting, there's a winter grafting or a summer grafting. There's different techniques.
There's always a lot to know.
Yes.
Many thanks to Monica Aske.
Sometimes it's nice to look back on past episodes to recall memorable features and memorable people. And one such person is Tom Lewis, otherwise known as the Cambridge wine blogger. Tom was a regular on Flavour with his monthly wine features, and sometimes we'd attend his wine events too. In this next feature, we go back 5 years to the basement of Cambridge Wine Merchants when it was on Mill Road, where Tom was hosting a Cru Bourgeois wine tasting. The setup was this: 10 guests, some with wine knowledge, others getting into it for the first time, tasting six wines from the Medoc region of France, a coastal region sitting on the Atlantic and above Bordeaux.
Try and get a glug.
That was made for radio, though.
You're good at
the Cru. Welcome, everyone. These are six Cru Bourgeois wines from Bordeaux. Cru Bourgeois is a classification of wines from the Medoc, which is on the left bank in Bordeaux. The Medoc is a spit of land that sticks out almost into the Atlantic. It's divided into two parts. There's the Haut Medoc and what used to be known as the Bas Medoc. So the Haut Medoc is the higher, and typically that's where the better wines come from. The Bas Medoc, lower down, and typically the wines aren't as good. Partly for that reason, partly for reasons of delicacy, the Bas Medoc has got rid of that Bas from its name, and is now just calls itself the Médoc because they don't like the negative connotations of being a little bit lower and suggesting that they're inferior. So four of the wines we've got are Au Médoc, two of them are Médoc. So what I suggest we do is just try our way through all of them and see which ones we like best.
I made wine from the lilac tree.
For people who go to a supermarket and buy a bottle of wine, do you think that is very complex, the wine, they can appreciate it, or maybe it's too complex?
There are wines that are easy to understand and wines that are harder to understand, and I suppose it depends how much effort you want to put into it. But then there are wines that you can try and you just think, this is lovely. You know, these are very young, so I think they are a little harder to understand, but, you know, given them the right number of years, serve them at the right time and the right circumstances, they will be lovely.
Is this your first wine tasting?
Yes.
What attracted you?
A new interest in wine and champagne distribution and taste in Cambridge Market.
Put my heart in its recipe.
Even though I lived in Australia for many years, you have to recognise that French wine is a terrific sort of area of wine. So I was interested to try these, what turns out to be left bank wines, even though the grape mix was slightly strange because it's using a right bank mix.
Essentially, the Cabernet does better on the left bank, Merlot does better on the right bank. The right bank is clay, and that keeps it a bit cooler. The Cabernet needs slightly warmer conditions, so that's why it doesn't do well on the clay.
Are we scoring it?
Just make any notes you like, you know, either liked it, didn't like it.
And what will you do with the results?
Nothing in particular.
it's just our edification.
Yeah, absolutely. No, just it'd be interesting to see who like. I mean, what's always interesting at the end of these is to try and get a group favourite.
Yeah.
Makes me see what I want to see.
After letting it revolve a bit in the glass, I found more fruit in the mouth.
Mm. Okay, that's quite grippy, isn't it, on the finish?
Mm. Mm. But the smell is nearly like pork, right? Mm.
It's slightly more full, but it still has that raw sense.
Mm.
La la
When I put down there something, there's a bit of cigar box. It's a similar sort of thing, isn't it? Something quite aromatic and woody.
Yeah, I think woody. Wooden, sort of. There is something aromatic, but I cannot put my finger on it. I don't have the sound.
It's like fruity, isn't it?
I mean, for me, there's a lot of cool mint on that. Really
dominating. There's something fresh at the back, but I cannot put my finger on it.
How do you rank the colour of a wine?
Is it grapes, I guess?
The colour's going to change with time. These are young wines, so we're not looking for sort of eight signs of age. What we're looking for is sort of the depth of colour. It'll tell us something about the amount of concentration, the amount of dry extract there is in there. So the darker they are, generally, the more there is going on. So these are relatively pale, relatively translucent. So there's not a lot of extract and concentration in there. They're quite light and fresh.
It's sweet and heady.
I know that champagne is a white wine but uses black grapes. But normally the colour of the grapes dictates the colour of the wine, doesn't it?
Well, what dictates the colour of a wine is not the colour of the grapes that grow in, but the production method. Mm. So where the grapes are crushed or pressed. If you press it and just take the free-run juice, as you do for a white wine, then you're just taking the juice from the flesh of the grapes, so you won't get any colour extracted. If you crush them and then you keep the skins in contact with the juice, then you'll get colour, flavour. The flavour are mainly on the skins. You'll get that added into the juice, and that's what gives the red wine its colour. So the problem is if you're too heavy-handed with that, then it'll just taste over-extracted, and I think the first two wines were a little bit like that. There's too much. Unless you crush them quite gently, you risk extracting too much bitter tannins from the grapes that then leaves the wine out of balance. Do we like this one?
Yeah, we do. Yeah.
I like this one.
Yeah.
Favourite
so far.
This one has one heart.
It's a summary measure.
Because this was Radio 4 Extra, we'd be getting steadily more plastered as the movies go around. and raucous.
I actually thought that was the better one of the three so far.
I think that's the best so far.
Perfect equilibrium between... Jean, what's souplesse?
Suppleness.
Thank you. Souplesse? Between the suppleness, the roundness of the Merlot and the power of the Cabernet Sauvignon.
Hmm.
I drink a lot of wine, but I don't claim a great knowledge of it. A bit like art, you know what you like.
Yeah. I drink much more than I ought to drink.
You like this one?
Yeah. Mm. Slightly
sweet, isn't it? Mm. The word I use is plumper.
Plumper, is it?
Yeah, it's got a sort of plumpness to it.
Right.
And I think, it's sort of... My analogy for this is it needs to be a bit like Nigella. You know, you're looking for that sort of plump flirtatiousness.
Steady.
But you also...
It's drifting off. It's a family show.
But, you know, you want a sort of, a degree of sort of, assertive focus as well. So it's both. It's got to have some sort of focus to it, but also, it has to have a bit of curvaceousness as well.
Ooh. A cheeky little number.
Yeah. I feel
unsteady. And what I like as well, I used to go to Bacchanalia a lot in Victoria. Mm. And I don't know why, but since I left France, being in the UK for like 15 years, I seem to think the best one is the most expensive. When I kind of failed to choose one, I would ask, I don't know his name.
Paul.
And he would say, I recommend this one. And it would be like a £5 bottle. Mm. And it would be, it sounds wrong in my head because I feel it's not expensive enough for some reason. But he's recommended me so many really nice. Okay. I mean, obviously, the one I was talking about, the Pinacobos, that's something different. You pay, but you know it's going to be like, wow. You maybe discover like a Portuguese white wine. I think it was a Verdeiro or something. It looked like nearly green. I've drank so much of those, it's unbelievable. And it's under £10 for a reason.
I don't want to give this one up.
Do you like this one?
I to keep this one.
We've got some spare glasses. We can do more glasses.
Good
color. Actually, there we go.
It's all subjective, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, my favourite is the last wine.
The last wine?
Yeah, I like that one.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah. Full mark on anything else.
Yeah.
Why did you feel it was the best one?
I don't, same colour, better nose, longer palate. Maybe I like Merlot. 75% Merlot in it. Definitely my best of the six.
Could you just explain longer palate?
Well, the length of a wine that it just runs on and on and on. Keep tasting it a long time after you've drunk it.
Listen to me, I cannot see clearly.
Do we all like
it? I like the last one.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I like the second to last one, but I think it's because of the context. I found the first four very thin and dry, and the aftertaste to be very strong.
Mm.
And so the last two have more full flavours to them. So the last one is more sweet, definitely.
Yeah. Mm. Had a sweet tinge to it.
Mm. The second to last was the most refreshing.
I think this is my favourite, actually, the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mad because I hate having it. When I smell leather, I just go down the loop. I'm going to put my heart in this one.
Maybe it's a preference, a slight preference for right bank.
Mm. Is that what you prefer?
Well, I used to always think I was left bank. I'm beginning to think I'm slightly... changing religion, isn't it? I think I'm slightly more right bank now.
My favourite one is the last one as well.
Oh, good.
And it's a little bit sweet, so...
Yeah. It's Paris bronze, it's got a Cambridge gold.
Well, I suppose the real assessment is to try the Cru Bourgeois against something that doesn't have a Cru Bourgeois classification and see whether, on average, we feel that the Cru Bourgeois are the better wines than the ones that are assessed to be in the same area but haven't been selected for inclusion.
Time just right.
I think it's been a very interesting day, and they're always interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, I go to several things at Cambridge Wine Merchants. You meet different people, and every time you learn something. And you never finish learning, of course. Never, ever.
Or from a basement on Mill Road.
Mill Road basements are the best.
There's a few bottles, there's a little drop in the bottle left, so do you want to pick the one that you liked the most and take a little bit with you?
Which one was yours? Mine.
Well, thanks very much, Tom.
Enjoy that.
Thanks,
Tom. Appreciate it. Yeah, cheers, Brian. Nice to see you.
See you again soon.
Nice to meet you, Brian.
No.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, look forward to seeing you next time, I hope.
Okay. Thank you.
All the best.
We're going to disappear.
It was really fun recording that evening, and nicer still to have met those people at wine events around the town since. Cambridge is a small place, and this is where it really benefits. Tom still regularly updates his blog site, the Cambridge Wine Blogger. His latest article, from this Thursday, being on the Anderson Port, aged in wood for several years, and then bottled as a ready-to-drink port.
And that's all we have time for today. Apologies for the lack of our regular news and job section and tweets. Normal business will resume next episode. Speaking of which, you can catch us live on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m. Our repeat is on Sunday at 2 p.m. and then podcast early in the week.
And coming up next on Cambridge 105 Radio Today is Jazz Today with Pete Butchers continuing his chat with David Gower and John Blandford about the upcoming Cambridge International Jazz Festival. Polish Waves is at 5, combining British and Polish cultures with news, music and entertainment. And From the Terraces is here at 6 o'clock with the latest footballing action from Cambridge United, City and Histon Town. The Big Band Show is on at 7, presented by John Hammond. And Jackie Bond returns at 8 with another edition of Let the Good Times Roll, rock and roll music from the 50s up to the present day. Rebel Arts Radio takes to the airwaves at 9 p.m, and our alternative music show Stagger is at 10 with a choice mix of electronica, rap and experimental tunes. And then we round off our Sunday broadcast, as usual, with another chance to hear Bookmark, our fortnightly show featuring Cambridge-based writers.
But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 23rd of November, so until then, goodbye.